The course comments survey is a document that you can evaluate the various lectures. If this is your one and only time in the class, you don't have to fill it out. But it is a review of the previous speakers and the course in general. The second handout is student project presentations. And this is to review the student projects, and everybody will have a chance to review the students' presentations. So at the end, please pass that back to me. That'll be good. A couple more administrative items. First of all students, the registrar has an online course evaluation, which is different than the paper one that I just passed around. And for filling that out, you get your grades early. Otherwise, you don't see your grades until later on. So it behooves you to fill that out. And for students working on projects, there's two class reports that are required. First is the project report, which is a team-based report. I want a printed copy in a bound volume by Friday afternoon. The other thing is an individual personal reflection, and that's due at the same time, but you can send that to me by email. So it doesn't need to be printed out. And the information on how to prepare these reports were in assignment 2. And finally, any team who has expenses that would like reimbursed, please see Bernice in the design division office again by Friday. And she's already forewarned that there may be some reimbursements done. So obviously you're going to need a receipt. Okay. For the students, I would appreciate a soft copy of the report and the slides whenever you have a chance. And they will be posted on the website for all to see. And at this time, I'd like to personally thank everybody who made this course possible. And thanks especially to all the presenters for the excellent job they did in providing information on the broad scope of assistive technology. Some of these presenters travel from great distances, San Francisco, San Rafael, Santa Rosa, and Minden, Nevada. I would also like to acknowledge all the people who have suggested projects, who have worked with the students throughout the quarter on their project. The Haas Center for Public Service has provided funding for the course and is sponsoring the barbecue this afternoon. And additional funding has come from EnableMart and the Atkinson Foundation. I would also like to extend my appreciation to all the students who enrolled in the class and to members of the community who have added to the discussion. Finally, I would like to thank Professor Drew Nelson, who has given me the opportunity to organize this class and has gently provided wisdom and guidance. Thank you, Drew. Okay. We have 3 presentations this afternoon. 3 student teams have been working this quarter to identify particular problems in assistive technology and to design a solution that meets those needs. Through background research, interviews with users, and design brainstorming, they have narrowed their concepts to a single design. These projects will be prototyped and tested next quarter. And again, I appreciate your assistance in reviewing these team project presentations. The first presentation is from Team Liquid Metal. And this team is exploring the unique properties of liquid metal. It's an alloy that would make a superior white cane for blind travelers. Okay. Thank you.
Sorry. I guess I'll start with an introduction. My name is Egan. I'm a senior mechanical engineering. I started as a group of three, but seniors tend to get a little antsy towards the end of senior year and decide not to keep going with the project. But it's been interesting, so I kept working on it. And basically, what I've been doing is working with a few people that are visually impaired and getting feedback on different canes that they use, how they use them, and sort of improvements that they'd like to see. This is sort of a market that up until there hasn't been a lot of new push in terms of the design of canes, and so spending a little time and seeing what the problems are and where rooms for improvement has been pretty interesting and pretty successful. Let's see if I can get this working. All right. I apologize if I seem a little flustered. Mechatronics presentations were last night and been a little short on sleep and preparation time. But it went well. We took the blue ribbon. That's good. Yep. Okay, so my project coach was Noel. He's a cane user who was blinded when he was 19 years old with a little pyrotechnics accident. He's got a big engineering background. His father's an engineer, and he's spent a lot of time thinking about this, so a lot of the information that I'm saying now came straight from him. So to start, I'm just going to talk about the white cane, who uses it, how and why it's used, some the important properties and design considerations, the materials that are currently used, some other similar technology, and then like the big downfalls with the products that are on the market right now. While I do that, I'll pass around a couple different models. There's a couple folding ones and a couple straight ones, an aluminum, two graphite, and a fiberglass one. These are pretty standard. The aluminum and graphite are tend to be used for the folding canes, so like the tent pole design. I couldn't get a telescoping one, but those are sort of like the widest used products on the market. So in terms of who uses them, there's approximately 750,000 people considered legally blind in the United States alone. So this number is also like steadily increasing as the population ages. The way they're used, they're a mobility device, and a person that is blind basically employs like a sweeping motion with the cane to feel out the ground in front of them to navigate around a household outside. I'm sure everybody's seen it. The important properties, the rigidity of the cane. You can't have a lot of flex as you're walking because you can't feel the ground as well. You need to tell the difference when you're like about to go onto the grass, when you're on cement, when you're on the sidewalk, when you're going from the sidewalk to the asphalt. The tactile feedback is really important. For this reason, a lot of people, when they're walking outside, tend to use the long, straight fiberglass canes because there's no rigidity loss in the different segments. The weight's important, especially in elderly populations, as they're using these canes. And you have to hold it out in front and you're sweeping it back and forth. You want to avoid arthritis and wrist problems, and that tends to be an issue. The acoustical properties are actually something I didn't know. People that are blind often can have like a large amount of sonar navigation, and so they're actually able to navigate around just by like snapping their fingers or clicking or tapping their cane on the ground and listening to the audio feedback from walls around them. They can tell the difference when they're walking by a post, when they're under a tree. There's a lot there, and oftentimes they'll use the cane to sort of bounce on the ground and listen to the time response. So those are the sort of the main properties. The tip of the cane is really important because that's controlling the tracking along the ground. Current materials used, as I mentioned, are graphite, fiberglass. They've tried titanium, yes. Aluminum. Carbon fiber is used, which is just a higher quality fiberglass and more expensive. These are sort of the current designs. There's the tent pole, which is basically an elastic strap down the middle, connecting all the segments. So you just like separating a tent pole, it comes apart. There's also a telescoping one that sort of the segments fit inside of each other. And then as I mentioned, there's the long straight canes that don't collapse at all. Similar technology on the market. There's a lot of design has gone into sort of hiking poles and tent poles, or like walking sticks. So there's different collapsible walking sticks that you can find at REI that sort of employ similar things but have a wider user base, and some more time is spent engineering and developing them. In terms of shortcomings, there's always a desire to have the cane more rigid, lighter, less subject to failure. Canes will actually fail a lot. The aluminum models, they'll get caught in somebody's legs who's walking in front, person will turn, and that'll permanently deform the aluminum. Fiberglass tends to splinter, so you get one person steps on it wrong, or you get a point contact and it starts to splinter, and then it's pretty much done. So while they're pretty cheap, there's always a desire to have them lighter, stronger, more rigid. In terms of the collapsible canes, there's the big shortcomings with them is they lose a lot of their tactile feedback with the different segments. You can't feel the ground as well because they tend to lose the elastic cords in the middle tend to stretch out and they stop working as well. So I've got some pictures of just different canes that are on the market. There's the folding graphite and folding aluminum tend to be the most common. They're nice because if you're going in and out of vehicles or getting on a bus, traveling around outside, but then you're going indoors, you don't want to have just a long straight cane. The long straight fiberglass cane tends to be used if you're just out walking, you're not worried about transportation and getting in a small space later on. The cane tips here, a couple different ones. There's sort of like the furniture stop, the marshmallow. It's sort of based on user preference, but you can change them out. But it's definitely an important thing that changes just the feel of the cane and the weight distribution. Here's some of the similar technology I was talking about. There's like the hiking poles and walking sticks, ski poles also. They've spent a lot of time and money developing these things, and you can buy a pair of $100 or like a $100 walking stick that basically folds up and fits in a backpack. The same amount of engineering hasn't necessarily been spent in designing the long white canes. There's also been additional features that have been tried and added on. On the right up here, on the right, there's a sonar range finder basically. So someone, they'll have a cane in one hand and they can use it to sort of feel how close they are to a bookshelf or a wall. It's accurate up to like 4 or 5 feet, but it's something that's been tried. They've tried implementing those on a cane. This right here actually has a camera sensor feedback system, so it'll actually sort of steer you as you work. So a large part of my time has been spent looking at sort of a way to redesign it. One big thing that I was clued into is this new material, amorphous metal alloys. They were developed. They started to show up in consumer products in about 2003, and they haven't been applied to canes yet. You're seeing them in golf clubs, sporting goods, things that have a fast turnover and are like large money markets. But amorphous metal alloys are basically they're also called glassy metals, but they're, instead of having a crystalline structure, they're more of a floating structure, and they've got some really unique characteristics and properties that you don't see anywhere else. Most notably, they're like really high yield strength. They're really resistant to wear. They won't shatter. They have the ability to elastically bend a whole lot and maintain their original shape. So unlike aluminum, where you bend it a little bit, it's bent and that's it, you can bend these things way, way more. It'll bounce back almost like fiberglass. So they share a lot of characteristics as plastics, especially thermoplastics, in terms of their, but they maintain like the sort of like the properties of metal that you'd like the hardness and the strength. They're actually even more strong than most metals. And they can be enhanced by mixing in different elements. They're a really versatile sort of new substance that hasn't been tried in this market yet. They're showing up in medical devices, basically everywhere. So basically the need is a cane that is lighter, more resistant to wear, one that won't deform when it's been bent, stronger, lasts longer, and won't fail catastrophically when somebody steps on it. These amorphous metal alloys have the potential to make a big difference in this. And I think I have some charts. So the yield strength, this liquid metal is basically a commercial name for an amorphous metal alloy. But the yield strength over something like aluminum or steel, it's way, way more. The elastic limit, the elastic limit is basically the ability to bend it and have it return to its original shape. And so, as you can see, this is on the level of something like fiberglass, like that, but then it won't splinter as fiberglass would. In terms of affordability, or actually, in terms of working with liquid metal, it has some really interesting characteristics. It tends to, it melts at a really low temperature, so you can actually like cast it really affordably, almost like a plastic. And this makes sort of the range of applications really, really wide. You can make basically shapes that you can't make in metal. A disadvantage when you use something like steel and you cast it, the as cast form tends to be much lower strength than the wrought form. So this is something that, because the amorphous metal maintains its shape as it cools, that's not an issue at all, and it's actually just as strong as if you cast it versus forge it or whatever. In terms of affordability, it's about the price of carbon fiber or some higher-end fiberglass, about the price of titanium as well. So aluminum and crude fiberglass is cheaper, but right now you can buy the turnover in canes, the life of canes is pretty short, and you buy a new one every few months when they bend or break. So this would be one that'd be a little bit more expensive, but not unreasonably so, and it could definitely work as material. So from here, basically next quarter, I'll be spending my time looking more into this metal and trying to get an actual production run. I've been talking to a few companies that are commercially licensed on the patent to use this material, and trying to get them to encourage them to form a cane out of it, and hopefully we'll keep going with that and see how that goes. So Yeah, based on feedback from developers, and there's actually a few professors here in the material science department that helped develop these glassy metals, that it's definitely a viable option and has a lot of potential. I'd just like to say thank you to the VISTA Center for the blind, or of the blind, which is in downtown Palo Alto. They're a huge help in the whole project and actually let me follow along and undergo a training session using the cane. They lent the canes and they've been a huge help. Also, the project coach, Noel, he couldn't be here, but he wanted to. He was a huge help, and Dave. So I guess at this point, any questions or comments? Yeah. Well, I didn't even mention that. In terms of the color, canes are also largely used for identification purposes, so to alert motorists, other people, that the user is visually impaired. That's why they're white. I did look at other designs. There's been a fair amount of development in terms of sort of like the ski pole ideas, and the earlier ones are they're not very refined, but some of the earlier models are actually really nice. Like they'll collapse and then you can just shake them out, and you unfold them and just kind of shake it, they'll lock into place, and they're pretty rigid. I mean, it's about as good a job as you could do at with graphite or whatever. I don't know. In terms, I just didn't see very much room in design. I looked at a lot of the different cane models and talked to cane users, but I didn't really see any potential for drastic development. Yeah.
Onto a cane.
Actually, yeah, that one I showed, it actually is equipped with a headphone set. You can't see it, but there's been different things using sonar, using range finders they also make a pair of sunglasses that you can wear that has range finders on it. So when you're using a cane, you cover pretty much all the ground in front of you, and that's fine, but if there's like an overhanging ledge, there's no way to alert yourself as to something like that. So you'll see people that are visually impaired wearing sunglasses for eye protection and like a brimmed hat to prevent run-ins like that. So that's definitely like an interesting thing I looked into. In terms of applications to an actual cane, I don't know if it's something that you'd want like built into like the walking stick you're using. I sort of got mixed opinions on that. A few of the people I talked to said that they had tried one and it was just like not worth it. Just made it heavier, more awkward, and it didn't actually work that well. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It making like a hollow tube of liquid metal. I mean, they made like golf club shafts, tennis racket brims. It's definitely an option. It's sort of like the most versatile, because no matter how like you form it, it's always the amorphous metal, the amorphous atomic structure, and so the properties are the same, which is pretty unique. Yeah.
Do you have any feel for the increased cost of a cane using liquid metal versus a regular cane?
I mean, I think right now you can buy like sort of the long straight fiberglass canes for, I don't know, about $20. The collapsible one's probably close to $40, $50. I think if you jump to, I don't know, it's hard to tell, but probably three times as expensive if it's in, like, mass production. I don't know. It's about the same as using, like, a carbon fiber.
And you have a sample of liquid metal that you can show us afterwards?
Oh, right, sorry. a little flustered. I apologize. I meant to pass this around when I started talking about liquid metal, but here's a big plate of Vitriloy 1, which is one of the more common ones. I'll pass it around. You'll notice it feels like a metal, but the thermal properties, it's like a little bit different. So it's pretty cool. There's also to show the elastic properties. This is something a professor on campus had. So there's a plate of liquid metal right here, just a smooth polished plate, and then a polished plate of titanium. And these are just like steel ball bearings. And so you just drop them from the same height, and you see the liquid metal, the elastic impact, the point of contact, it just keeps going. If this was like a hardened steel, it would be damped out by now. If it was, no matter, like you put it up against any other compound, it'll keep bouncing 2-3 times as long. Huh? Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Next up is it's the food probably. Hold on. Hello. Yeah. Oh. No, you just have to get on campus and follow the maps and park perhaps near the Oval. And find your way to the Meyer Library. Please look at the map. I sent you 5 maps. Okay, we're sort of behind Hoover Tower. Okay. Okay, thanks. Okay, thanks, bye. Oh.
And if we want to end the show, can we go to something else?
Go ahead. I think it's thinking that this is the second monitor, so you got to change it to make it so that this is the same one. There you go.
We'll be changing around. I don't
know. Okay. All right.
Cerebral palsy who are learning to walk. Combining innovative audio effects with a fun, portable design, the device will encourage users to keep walking outside of physical therapy classes.
So as Dave said, we're team Let's Get Physical. And my name is Roseanne.
My name is Whitney King.
My name is Nidia.
And today we'll be talking to you about our device, showing you a prototype, and telling you about all our cool ideas and where we'll be taking the project from here.
Okay, so our problem that we're trying to address is that of lack of time practicing gait for children who are in physical therapy. And so we came about this problem by talking to Dr. Jessica Rose, who's the director of the Gait Analysis Lab here at Stanford. And when we met with her at the beginning of sort of our project ideas, One of the things that she mentioned is very important is the fact that kids only, like a normal toddler who is just learning to walk, spends walks the distance of about several football fields a day while they're learning to walk. Whereas kids who have some sort of gait problem or just suffer or have cerebral palsy or any of these things that Rosie will talk about later do not get to practice as much. They just spend the time in physical therapy and then maybe, you know, a half an hour here, an hour there at home. So this definitely compared to just the average toddler trying to get their gait down is not a very good amount. So our goal was to design a device that appeals to children. We wanted to make it portable and easy to use at home to address this problem of children being able to practice at home or wanting to practice at home as well. And, you know, our third goal was to encourage walking, so make it a motivational device that the kids would be excited about walking around.
So before we go into the specifics of our design ideas, we wanted to touch briefly on some of the important aspects of designing for children, because that's a new thing that we haven't talked about yet in this class, and the issues of children and user acceptance for products. So four important issues that we identified were, first, the rapid pace of development. So kids grow and learn much faster than adults. They're changing very quickly. So what an important goal of a product that's designed for children is to meet their needs at their current stage of development and also pull them into the next stage and satisfy their needs for a longer period of time. And the second important issue is that children are not purchasers of these devices. So we're going to need to talk to the parents and the family members of the users of our motivational device and make sure that they're well integrated into the design process as well. Third important point is that observations are going to be really valuable when we're testing our device on users, because unlike adults, kids often don't know exactly what they want from a device or what's possible through engineering, and they will be able to see how they react to their device, and that'll be the most important part of it. And the fourth important point is that for physical therapy exercises in particular, they can have the ability to integrate children into the community or alienate them. And this here is a picture of those two exact things. So we have the kid who's just doing the physical therapy exercises, and he's getting his advantage he's building muscles, but he isn't really doing anything for the community or working with anyone else. And then in the second picture, we have him actually helping and feeling like a valuable member of his community through his exercise.
Okay, so I want to walk you through some of the design concepts that we started out with. So our first design was a standing and balancing aid. An important thing to note, all of our design concepts came out of our talks with either Dr. Rose or a physical therapist. So this first one, standing and balancing aid, it would basically use force plates and something like shoes, and it would measure how much force each person was putting down on each leg. So this is really focused around balancing. And if there was an equal amount of balance on each leg, then music would play. But if they were like shifted to the right or shifted to the left and they were uneven, and the music would stop, and this would let them know that they're balanced or not. The second design came out of a talk with a therapist. He showed us the bicycle exercise machine and a trike that kids could use who had disabilities. So modeling around that, we thought of kind of like if you think of like a box car where you can sit down and pedal with your feet, and you can also like integrate hand controls into there. So if you were going to do physical therapy at home around a bike or a trike, you could, like, actually take this, sit down, like, bike around the corner, like, take it outside, but, like, continue to practice your physical therapy. And then our last design, which is a DJ, it's a walking motivator. It's actually what we decided to go ahead and look into, so we're going to talk about that in just a couple slides.
So as Whitney said, we've been working closely with Dr. Rose from the gait and motion analysis lab at the Lucile Packard Children's Hospital. And there they do a lot of work with kids with cerebral palsy. So they would be one of the prime users of our DJ motivational device. But there are also a lot of other groups of people that could benefit from this, including kids that have short or long-term injury, people with muscular dystrophy, spina bifida, or people who have undergone strokes. And this all comes under the category of children with walking disabilities who are undergoing physical therapy treatment. And that's a picture of a kid at the Lucile Packard Children's Hospital going through his gait motion treatment. So So some of the existing solutions that people have come up with to help children learn to walk or adults learn to walk who have muscular problems are, first, the gait trainer. That's specifically for kids. And this device actually costs about $1,200, $1,200 to $1,300. So it's very expensive. And it's a lot of just keeping them upright and making sure that they can stand on their own and walk. But as you can see, some of the drawbacks are it doesn't look particularly fun or that they would want to use it for an extended period of time. Then 2 and 3 are both projects that have been developed by students as part of the NSF design project. So we have the Steady Stepper, which is for was developed for an older person who wants to keep walking and who has cerebral palsy, but it's a weight-bearing device so that they can exercise safely at home. And the third is a walking motivator. It's a pedometer and an MP3 player, so it detects the person's stepping motion and plays music when they're walking. And the fourth picture here is a design that was developed in third world countries to help people who have the same problem. And it's just a very simple solution and very cost effective. And it helps improve their gait in addition to keeping them walking. So it was originally just a walker with a chair on the back, but the chair actually functions to make sure that the person is keeping up their pace with their feet.
Sort of a preliminary picture of what the DJ would look like. So we have it being very small in size, you can see. And we have a handle for carrying, so the black little semicircle you see there. Two push handles for better weight support. Our prototype has one, but then we thought more about it, and we were like, it would be much better, you know, if kids have balance problems, to have two handles so they have more to hold on to. And then we're also thinking about pursuing telescoping poles as the handles to adapt to various users. You know, kids grow pretty fast, so having various heights that that the handles could be used at, and it'd also be more practical to carry around. You know, not having these like two poles popping up from the top. And another cool thing is that you can also attach it to a walker. So if, you know, the user is just has very poor balance or gets tired very quickly, they could also use the walker for support and then just attach the DJ to it. So this is kind of some of the things they have now. So you've probably seen one of these before.
So we built a basic prototype to try and. No, it's not. It's off. It's off. So we're gonna see if this should work.
Good. It works. Maybe not.
Oh, hold on. Let's see. Do it again.
There we go.
It's a little finicky, but we're just trying to build a prototype to kind of get the basic idea of what would happen. So, like, as you roll, it would play music. We have magnets aligning things, but I think it just keeps slipping off. But if you roll, it plays music, and then we have to figure out a way to, as soon as you stop, the music will also stop. In terms of the electrical design for that, we're looking into a lot of different ideas. The first one is called a dynamo, and you can see it kind of attaches in the spindles of the bike. And as you rotate any of the wheels, this creates it converts this into electrical current, so it's kind of like a generator. And then we can pick up the electrical current in a circuit and use that to tell whether the person is walking or not. We can also incorporate things like microprocessors and microcontrollers, especially since I just came from 210. I learned a little bit about those. But basically, we can stream inputs and figure out if the person is walking or not. And if they're above a certain threshold, then we can say microprocessor, like turn on a relay switch. I'll talk about that in a second, to close the circuit and music will play. If they're below a certain threshold, so they're not moving, then open the circuit and nothing will play. Speaking of relays and generators, so I just was talking about how a relay would work with a microprocessor to kind of get the feedback that we wanted. A relay is just a basic switch, so it opens and closes, And as I said, you can use it with the microcontroller. If it's open, the circuit's not complete, and so nothing will happen. And as soon as it senses that they're moving, it'll close, and the music will start playing. We're also looking into some basic research for an accelerometer, which measures how many G's the person is like putting on our actual device. And if it's above a certain threshold again, then we can use that to know that it's moving, and we can translate that into play music.
So looking further, some of the pros and cons of the DJ. As I mentioned before, current things play mechanical music like the little toy we showed you, and not popular music, which would be a lot more fun and exciting. It would be universal, so it would entice children without a disability as well because of just like the fun aspect of it. It would be portable. You can push by hand or by attaching to the walker, as we mentioned, and just like the cool factor. So Rosie talked about integrating versus alienating, and we think that this device would do that. Like it would attract other kids who are playing, around someone who's trying to use the DJ and be like, oh, how fun, like let's have a little dance party over here. And then some of the cons are that it does not yet address the issue of poor gait. And it could get annoying for parents, which we mentioned before, like the key supporters of like the use of the device. So that's another factor. And then something we want to explore more is at what point would it become old? Would the enticing, exciting factor of the DJ become old to the user? And then last week, Debbie Kennedy brought up a few really interesting points that we talked about later, and one of them was that training for devices is key or success level will be low. So one of the things we like about the DJ is that little training is required. The kids probably know, the idea of pushing from other toys they have, so we think that will simplify things. And then also she mentioned repetition is key, and this is already the primary idea behind our design. They pretty much have portable entertainment and exercise all in one. So we think that that will allow for the repetition.
Okay, so now taking some of the drawbacks of our device that we have identified and turning them into future work, we have first task at hand will be talking to users. So we've had extensive meetings with Dr. Rose and with physical therapists, so we have a pretty good idea of what kids are looking for from talking to them, but we need to actually take it to kids now. Now that we have a working prototype, we can do that. The second main task will be to improve the sound design and music playing capabilities, so implementing our electrical ideas and integrating them with the mechanical. And finally, as Nubia said, we'd like it to not only encourage them to walk, but encourage them to walk properly, and so we're going to think of ways to incorporate gait analysis into that. And here is a picture of the gait cycle, so the basic steps and seeing how we can get kids with cerebral palsy to follow that. So here's a project timeline that we've identified for working on this into ME113 next quarter, just our basic goals. So for April, we'll mostly be working on building the body and the electrical systems, and then into May, we'll be integrating and doing a lot of user testing. And that's our presentation, so if you have any questions.
What are the age groups that this would work with?
Well, the main kids that come into the GAIT lab are children ages, I believe, 5 to 15. And so depending on how well they receive the device from our user testing, that'll be something we figure out, but it'll be a lot broader than the people that device appeals to. We know that for sure. And the fact that you can personalize what kind of music you want to play with it will definitely increase the age scope.
One of the ideas that we might be doing to address the proper gait
is that there are some sensors that you can put, like shoe insert, that they currently use for testing to see if, do you have that video? You want to see the video? From the Gate Lab, and you'll see that, you know, sometimes kids don't actually, like, ever touch, like, their heel never touches the ground, or when they have poor gait. So the device that we, or something that we're thinking about doing is having those shoe inserts then trigger playing the music, so not be attached to each other. And then just have, if the weight is on the proper, like on all four sensors, because they have four sensors, then they play music. So that's one thing that we're looking into. Rosie will show the video, but.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Do you know how to get it to come up?
Maybe it's possible, but it seems like integrating that kind of therapy device with like a video game would be a great way to do it, because music, especially with stopping and starting while you're trying to learn how to walk, can be really frustrating. Trying to annoy. But like a video game would be more than to score higher.
We kind of looked into that because we were looking at the electric components and the accelerometers, and the key actuator controller is actually activated by an accelerometer. So we were talking to physical therapists about possibly incorporating that into like the design. If we heard more from like the users, that is what they wanted. So that is definitely.
That would appeal to them.
I was thinking, well, just kind of based off your initial prototype, I'm guessing your first users are going to be possibly pretty young kids. Have you thought about the issue of safety and whether this should be used when you're guided by the parents, whether this can be used by young kids who try and walk by themselves?
Yeah, we definitely considered that issue, and that's partially what motivated our idea to attach it to a walker. So that would be a device that they already have and that the parents know they can use safely. And so if it's attached to the walker, it won't be, as you said, liable for them to pick up and just walk around with on their own. And we know that they can use it in a way that they've tested.
The two-handled version of the cat, one of the gate parameters that support the center is left-right symmetry. If you have a two-handled version with load cells in each one, now you can measure how much force is being put on each side and the timing between the left and right side. And that could be one of the measures. If you're looking at dynamos, you should also look into batteryless flashlights to generate enough power to make you run the thing without batteries.
Thanks again. Last but not least, we have the Elevate team, and they're addressing the need of a Stanford student who uses a powered wheelchair to access the elevator call button and press the button corresponding to the floor desired. Take it away, guys.
Okay, hi, everyone. I'm Kevin. We have John, David, and Kent, and together we are Elevate. Okay, among us, we are all MD students, graduate students, and I guess among us, we have some experience with like robotic design, medical device design, even automotive design. And you'll see as the presentation goes along that one of our core motivations for choosing the project we chose was our experience in mechatronics. So what exactly is our project? So this quarter, we decided to take on the task of improving elevator accessibility for a power wheelchair user. And some of our main parameters were cost and also ease of integration. We were not able to increase the width of the chair as it is. Yeah. Okay, and this, we were fortunate to have a schoolmate who we identified as one of our main users, and he was very cooperative with many of our interviews. And in this video, you'll see that he uses his table to actually slap a button, basically, to get to a particular floor. Notice the table is on the left side of his chair. So consider the geometry of any elevator. Suppose the buttons were in the corner of the right of the cabin. Then he will be unable to actually operate the buttons. And he gave us many stories where he was actually trapped. He got into the elevator, and then he realized he was unable to access the buttons, so he had to wait for a good Samaritan to appear and help him out.
And the table that he's using is a custom table that he designed in high school with his professor.
Yes, it
is. So it's not something that's a standard part of the wheelchair.
So during our interviews with Angelo, he also highlighted some other things we had to consider. For example, his chair is currently under warranty. So what this meant that any integration into his circuitry can void his warranty. So that was one of our main hiccups. That was one of our main constraints in actually how should we implement whatever we designed. Also, he has deteriorating arm strength. He currently uses a joystick to maneuver his power chair. So whatever control we implemented for or whatever device we implemented had to be easily controlled whether by a soft button or a joystick again.
All right, I was fortunate enough to speak with Lisa Sheffman at the DRC, or Office of Accessible Education, and she spoke to me about just what ways they're able to accommodate students that use powered wheelchairs. Currently, there are 3 registered people with the DRC, and that's just students. That doesn't include faculty members. So the issue is when a student has limited access to a facility, to a classroom, different forms of accommodations can take place. One in the form of providing tapes or streaming the lecture. And if it's in the advent of a class where it's a lab or they actually have to be within the classroom to participate, then there comes a more serious issue or problem. It's really difficult to change the location of a room. It costs a lot of money and it takes a lot of time. So that might not be a possibility. And in that situation, it might, in an extreme situation, they might have to recommend the student to take the class or equivalent class at another university and transfer the credit in. And this is obviously not an ideal solution to the problem, and this is going to be a more pervasive problem with the increasing number of people who will be using powered wheelchairs who are returning from the war, et cetera. And as Kevin was able to touch on, we were faced with a bunch of constraints. It needs to be low cost. It needs to be something that, you know, we can actually get to a user so that he can benefit from this. And it can't change the dimensions of the chair itself. One of the issues, as he touched on, was that there were a couple of elevator cabins that a person would get stuck in if there was not enough room. So obviously problem would be exacerbated if the width of the chair was increased. And like we said, we can't modify the chair itself because we'd void the warranty. And it would have to be able to run off a 12 or 24 volt batteries, ideally from the chair itself. And so we did a couple of different brainstorming solutions, and one, we did this after we did a couple of research, and there's very limited solutions to this problem or even attempts to address this problem. Currently, there is an elevator on campus that Angela actually was able to tell us about where it uses foot pedals as the actuators as for the call buttons. And as you saw, he uses a custom table. And besides that, one elevator I was reading about has the call button only in the lobby where you put in your desired floor, and then there are no call buttons inside. And so it does it has an algorithm that it's run that basically takes care of, you know, which elevator you should use to get to your floor the fastest. And it has an audible reference such that if, you know, someone can't see, they would know where they need to go. And but in the situation for someone who wouldn't be able to use that or actuate that button, that's not a help at all. So, and like I said before, this problem could be becoming more prevalent as, you know, there's an increase in veterans coming from the war, and really we wanted to take a look at how we could help students on this campus improve their accessibility to their education here is what it really comes down to. So during our brainstorming session, we looked at a couple different ideas. One of the more complicated ones was a robotic arm, and this would allow a person 6 degrees of freedom so that ideally they control it through hopefully a simple joystick or button actuator, and they could position it up, down, left, right, forward, and backwards. And then there was a linear actuator where they would just aim it with their chair, and then all they would need to worry about was pressing the button itself. Some other ideas were remote access or remote control over the elevator, just creating a network such that you could communicate with the elevator your preference or your desired floor. And a more universal approach to this problem would be to modify the elevator itself such that everybody could benefit from it, whether it be voice activation or something along those lines.
So in order to kind of go through the different brainstorming ideas that we had, we put together a matrix just kind of evaluating the different designs, rating them from 1 to 5, 5 being the best, and different areas, cost, complexity, time frame. And then we had a scaling factor that isn't on here. But what it came down to was that the ideal solution would be modifying the elevator to make it more accessible for everybody, primarily because we put a lot of importance on making a universal solution. But after that, since it's difficult to get past the safety codes on elevators, the linear actuator came through as kind of the most cost-effective and reasonable device to design in the kind of scope that we were looking at.
So, like Ken said, we went with the linear actuator idea, and so it's basically adding, so we know that the wheelchair that he has right now, it gives you basically 3 degrees of freedom. He's able to move forward and back, rotate, and he also can move vertically upward. So our device, we want to make it 2 degrees where he has those 3, and plus 2 gives him 5 degrees of freedom to activate the button. And with that, we want to make it as simple as possible for the user. So we were thinking making one button that just involves with circuitry and software, or make it 2 buttons where it can rotate the device and then push it out. So that would require 2 buttons. And we're also going to add a laser pointer basically for a target reference so he can look at, kind of think of a Predator where he has like a little laser on the shoulder. Same idea here. So.
using an off-the-shelf part, like an automatic harness.
Yeah.
So those are about $30 each.
So here's a quick simulation. So that's his wheelchair as is. He has a 16-inch plate that we were thinking that we could mount on. Again, there's some restriction on warranty, so it's kind of one of the things that we don't want to drill anything or anything like that, so we want to mount it. And then this is it contracting outward, and then it'll go back inward. And then can you play again, please? And then the rotation of it, so he can rotate it any way he wants it, wherever level he needs. And then when he finds his pinpoint from the laser target, he just contract it out and press the button. So,
so looking forward, what we need to do is review the design report for the project.
Design overview of the project, kind of review our most recent ideas with Angelo as well as other potential users to get some feedback, and then begin, once we've gotten that feedback and incorporated, you know, our intentions for the user interface, to start developing some of the electronics and control system. And then one of the important things is integration of this device to users' wheelchairs, trying figure out the potential costs and variability between different types of wheelchairs, and conduct some field testing. And challenges, we think the biggest challenge will be probably the user interface, making something that's modular, removable, but secure, and reliability will be a very important aspect to the device. With antennas, they do bend and kink, and we need to get a better sense of the lifetime of some of these devices, as well as the learning curve and how well it'll be integrated. So that's just kidding. So we welcome any questions and comments.
Do you have any data on what sort of force required to actuate the typical elevator
button? That was one of the things that we highlighted at the very beginning, but we needed equipment for that, and we didn't have anything in hand, but we know for continuous projects we need to quantify that, and we kind of test certain elevator buttons, and we're trying to find a standard for, there has to be a standard, a universal standard out there for all elevators, so we're still looking to that.
Angelo on board with your design concept?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh. Another design consideration that we thought of was when we interviewed Angelo, he was adamant about making something that was more useful than just pushing elevator buttons, something that would be more versatile. And so we thought that a device with these 2 degrees of freedom might be useful for also actuating light switches and, you know, other kind of simple daily tasks. So that was also another reason we kind of led into that linear actuator.
But you know what makes it rotate is basically just a bidirectional DC motor, and you can activate that as well as.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, that's what we were talking about in terms of the robustness of the camera setting. You know, and it's changing. Like, even on the car, you see, it may not go up all the way or go down all the way. So you have to work with how to make that increase the longevity of that as much as possible.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. I think the food is here finally. So please bring your appetite outside. And again, I want to thank you and all the students for their participation. And please fill out the comment sheets and the presentation evaluation sheets and get them to me somehow. And if you have any questions or would like to be involved or have ideas for next year's course, please contact me. Always looking for projects and ideas and people to help and money, of course. So please, I don't want anybody to go away without eating something because it looks like we're going to have a lot of food. So thanks again.
There's something around.